Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Adele Stan, a columnist with the American Prospect, who examines the significance of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's indictments of key Trump advisors and the likely political response in the Republican-controlled Congress. Matthew Gardner of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who assesses the winners and losers in the GOP tax reform plan and the real-world track record, which proves that trickle-down economics is a lie. And Yannick Joseph of the Haiti Renaissance Institute, who advocates the establishment of a national forestry corps to address Haiti's deforestation and soil erosion problem. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Two months after the Burmese army launched brutal attacks against Rohingya Muslim villages in retaliation for insurgent attacks, the United States is ending its military assistance to Myanmar. Since the attacks, over 600,000 refugees have fled to Bangladesh, triggering an international humanitarian crisis. Facing growing calls in Congress for economic sanctions against Myanmar, the State Department has rescinded invitations for senior security forces from Myanmar to attend U.S.-sponsored events and has announced that officers involved in what many observers believed are ethnic cleansing operations against the Rohingya are now ineligible for U.S. assistance. According to the Associated Press, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has blamed the ethnic violence on Myanmar's army, but did not blame the Southeast Asian nation's top civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who has remained virtually silent about the atrocities. President Trump, who will be taking his first trip to Asia in early November to attend the Regional Association of Southeast Asian Nations Summit in the Philippines, has not yet publicly condemned the military's brutal repression against the Rohingya. Virginia's influential African-American vote could swing the state's very tight governor's race between Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam, a Democrat, and former National Republican Party Committee Chair Ed Gillespie. The Virginia race is seen by many observers as a bellwether of the popularity of Donald Trump's presidency. Two liberal groups, the National Democratic Redistricting Committee and the Michael Bloomberg-funded group Every Town for Gun Safety Action Fund, are spending tens of millions of dollars to boost black turnout in the governor's race, a critical constituency in a low turnout off-year election. In recent days, Trump tweeted his support for Gillespie, declaring he would, quote, save our great statues slash heritage, referring to pro-slavery Confederate monuments. Thus far, Gillespie has refused to condemn the white nationalists and neo-Nazis who descended on Charlottesville this summer, which resulted in the murder of an anti-fascist activist. Meanwhile, The Nation magazine reports that the National and Virginia Democratic Party organizations have spent most of their ad dollars targeting white middle-class voters. Now, without a broad-based mobilization of African Americans, Democrats in Virginia risk losing a winnable race. In New Orleans criminal court, arrestees in orange jumpsuits wait to be heard by Magistrate Judge John Cantrell. Those appearing in court face charges ranging from drug possession to domestic violence and car theft. Judge Cantrell has a lot of discretion in granting bail, but he rarely releases a prisoner without imposing a $2,500 bond. The bail imposed, unaffordable to most poor defendants, forces many to sit in jail for months awaiting trial. Nationally, most people charged with a felony are required to post $10,000 in bail. Often, defendants and their families must rely on bail bondsmen, who typically charge about 10% of the full bail amount, to act as a guarantee or surety for the rest. If the defendant can't afford the bondsman's fee up front, many bond companies will set up an installment plan and charge interest, money that will never be refunded to the defendant, regardless of the outcome of the case. Anyone who can't afford to pay a bail bondsman will sit in jail until his or her trial ends. 70% of local jail inmates are in pretrial detention status, a major reason the United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. Over the past 25 years, there have been numerous attempts to reform the bail system. In the early 1990s, Washington, D.C. passed a law to end bail. 3 years ago, New Jersey released arrestees unless they posed a risk to public safety. Within 6 months, the number of those in jail awaiting trial fell by one-third. Connecticut passed similar reforms earlier this year. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The first indictments from special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into allegations that the Trump presidential campaign colluded with the Russian government were announced on the morning of October 30th. Former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort and his former business partner Rick Gates were indicted on 12 counts, including conspiracy against the United States, conspiracy to launder money, operating as an unregistered agent of a foreign principal, and making false and misleading statements. Prosecutors say Manafort laundered more than $18 million from overseas accounts. Manafort and Gates, who both entered not guilty pleas, posted $10 million and $5 million bonds respectively and were placed under house arrest. Possibly more significant is the revelation that former Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos had pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russian officials. There's speculation that Papadopoulos, who had been cooperating with investigators since his secret arrest in July, could have been wearing a wire to record conversations with Trump insiders. Your reporter spoke with Adele M. Stan, a columnist with the American Prospect, who examines the importance of the Mueller indictments and the likely political response in the Republican-controlled Congress.
The situation with this guy Papadopoulos, who I think is a new name to most of us, is really intriguing because this was a low-level guy who was on Trump's foreign policy advisory team, but who seems to have, you know, little foreign policy experience except for having been part of a model UN program in college. But he's offering to set up meetings for the campaign while he was on the campaign with Russians who are ostensibly close to Putin, at one point even saying he thought he could get a meeting with Putin himself, you know, on behalf of the Trump campaign. It turns out that the FBI did interview him back in January, and Papadopoulos apparently lied to them, lied to the FBI. So he winds up getting arrested, but they keep his indictment under seal until now. And so there's a lot of scuttlebutt that they kept him working for the government, you know, as an informant in the months intervening. And if that's the case, who knows what Mueller has right now, if this guy wore a wire or he had face-to-face meetings with people from the campaign staff that he had worked with and got admissions from them or whatever. So it's really kind of impossible to know exactly where this investigation is right now. But by the hysteria that we see on Twitter coming from the president himself, one might think that the president's a little nervous.
I wanted to ask you about something that has been roiling around for quite some time, and that is since Donald Trump pardoned Sheriff Arpaio in Arizona, there's been a lot of speculation that if Trump insiders are indicted and face prison time, that Donald Trump will offer pardons to those folks, which certainly could unravel a trial and the case against Trump and his campaign. There's other speculation that state charges, which are not susceptible to presidential pardons at the federal level, might take the place of the leverage over some of those who are indicted in the near term. What's your feeling about this power the president has to pardon and how it may affect this case?
It is troubling, right? Especially given this president, this particular president. And not that I would want to see the power of the pardon removed from the presidency. I'm not saying that. But in the hands of this particular president, under these particular circumstances, it is troubling. It doesn't necessarily upend the case per se, Scott, because the pardon is a pardon of a sentence, right? It's not a pardon from the crime. And that's what we saw with Arpaio, that, okay, so he doesn't go to prison, but he's still convicted. So what you can wind up with is an exposure of what happened, but then nobody goes to jail for it, right? Or nobody goes to federal prison. In terms of the issue that you wisely bring up about what states can prosecute and that which are immune, president cannot pardon somebody convicted on state charges. That is really particularly interesting in this case of the Trump-Russia collusion. So it's unlikely that a state can nail a campaign for colluding with a foreign power. That would be, for the most part, federal charges. But they can be charged for financial crimes. So, yes, you're quite right that that is, you know, one way that this could go. I mean, the Republicans are just not standing up to any of this. And it doesn't seem like any of the Democrats who are vying for positioning themselves for 2020 presidential run are really going hard after the Republicans either.
In terms of where this investigation may go eventually, if Robert Mueller puts together a case that really implicates Donald Trump directly, but doesn't charge him with a crime, it really falls to Congress, the House and the Senate both, to engage in impeachment proceedings. It seems like the Republican-controlled House and Senate aren't going to even go there. What's your speculation? If Donald Trump is indeed implicated, what do you think the response of the Republican Congress is going to be?
Well, I think there's a lot of variables, Scott, and one is how close to implication or implicated is Mike Pence. And I think that will be a factor. Now, Mike Pence, Vice President Mike Pence, led the transition. He was warned about retired General Mike Flynn's lobbying on behalf of the government of Turkey. You know, so Pence, not pure in any of this, although he presents himself as. And now, if there's anything that implicates him in a way that would be damaging to him, I don't think that we'll see articles of impeachment ever come out of the House of Representatives. I do think there's a slim chance they could come out of the House of Representatives, and that's the body that has to, from which they have to emanate if they're to happen. If they think Pence has gotten off, that he's not implicated, because here's the thing. You know who owns the Congress? I know you know this, and I know your listeners know this. The Koch brothers own the Congress. And Mike Pence owes his career to the Koch brothers, and they're very, very keen on him. So I really think there's a chance that Donald Trump really doesn't even want this tax reform bill, because if it goes through, he's in much greater risk of articles of impeachment being drawn up against him, because he is only president so long as the Koch brothers say he is, because of the power they hold in the House of Representatives.
That was Adele M. Stan, a columnist with the American Prospect and winner of the 2017 Hillman Prize for Opinion and Analysis Journalism. Find links to more analysis of the recent Trump team indictments and Stan's recent articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Republican-controlled U.S. House and Senate narrowly approved a joint budget resolution on October 26th, an important step on the way toward the party's goal of approving major tax reform legislation by the end of the year. While the budget resolution doesn't have the force of law, it allows Republicans to propose a tax bill that needs only 50 votes in the Senate, bypassing the threat of a Democratic filibuster that requires 60 votes for passage. Although all the details of the GOP tax reform proposal have not yet been announced, drafts of the bill specify tax cuts that cost $1.5 trillion over the next decade, where 80% of tax relief will benefit the top 1% wealthiest Americans. The plan calls for slashing the corporate tax rate from 35 to 20% and repealing the inheritance tax on multi-million dollar estates. Under the proposal, the number of tax brackets would decrease from 7 to 3 or 4, the standard deduction would be doubled, and the child tax credit would be increased. While President Trump and Republicans say their goal is to boost the economy and provide middle-class tax relief, the elimination of local and state tax deductions and other changes to the tax code could actually increase taxes on millions of working families. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Gardner, senior fellow with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who assesses the winners and losers in the Republican tax reform plan and the real-world track record, which proves that trickle-down economics is a lie.
The plan we're looking at right now, as following a long tradition of Republican tax cut plans, is very specific on the details of which tax rates will be cut and which taxes will be repealed. The estate tax, gone. The corporate alternative minimum tax, which is designed to make sure that all corporations pay at least something, gone. The basic corporate income tax rate would be sharply reduced from 35% to 20%. On the personal income tax side, the top rate would go down from 39.6% to 35%. There would be a special new tax break for what's called pass-through businesses. These are often described as by their advocates as small businesses, but really are just generally very big businesses that happen to use a different set of rules for paying income tax. Instead of paying taxes as entities, they pass through the tax on their profits to the owners of the business who pay on the individual side. And the plan here is to drop the pass-through business tax rate to 25% instead of the 39.6% top rate that we currently have. So they're leading with sharp reductions in almost all the taxes that upper-income Americans pay on the individual side. The vague part is how they're going to pay for it. It's generally recognized that tax reform has two components in a deficit-challenged environment. One is what you're going to do to the rates, and the other is what you're going to do to the base, that is, the stuff that's actually subject to the rates. The most straightforward diagnosis of what ought to be done is we need to close loopholes. You hear that language spoken by both sides all the time. On the corporate side in particular, we know that maybe half of all corporate profits are now being subjected to tax because of various loopholes. And so closing them seems like an important second component of this plan. Sadly, the outline we've been looking at most recently is pretty vague on many of the details of which loopholes would be closed. There's language about ending wasteful tax subsidies, but very little specific language on which ones would go away. On the individual side, there's a little more specificity. We know that the intention is to get rid of most itemized deductions while preserving only two, the charitable deduction and the mortgage interest deduction. Bad news is the very limited amount of loophole closing we're talking about is nowhere near enough by anyone's accounting to pay for the rate reductions. And the result is that we're looking at a multi-trillion dollar tax cut as it's currently configured over the next 10 years.
And Matthew, the rationale for Republicans for many decades now for cutting taxes for the wealthiest people in the United States is so-called trickle-down theory, where if you give tax breaks to the wealthiest folks, the theory goes you're going to create jobs and wealth and expansion that will benefit everybody in the middle and the bottom. But we have a record of these previous tax cuts, and it turns out from a lot of documentation and studies I've read that you can expand on here, trickle down is a hoax.
The harsh reality is that while this story has been told for sometimes very eloquently for 30 years now, leading back to the President Reagan's tax cuts in 1981, there's never been a documented case in which it actually worked. The problem is that every time we've enacted tax cuts in the last 30 years that have been based on this premise, we've had to backpedal as a nation. We've had to undo them. Sometimes, as in the case of the Bush tax cuts of 2001, it's taken a decade of pitched battle for Congress to realize in a bipartisan way that, you know, they really had just dug the hole too deep. In other cases, as was true in 1981, although people don't seem to want to remember it too much, it took about a year for Congress to realize that they'd overstepped their bounds and to start undoing the Reagan tax cuts. But in every case, whether it's these examples at the national level or more recently the Kansas tax cuts, which, you know, a lot of people have talked about in the last few years, they end up not working. These tax cuts end up primarily costing a lot of money bestowing huge tax benefits on the owners of businesses and their shareholders, on the best off Americans, and providing little or nothing in terms of demonstrable job growth, income growth, or even direct tax cuts for the rest of us.
That was Matthew Gardner, Senior Fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Find links to more analysis on the proposed Trump-Republican tax plan by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Hurricane Maria's destructive winds denuded much of the island of Puerto Rico's trees in lush tropical forests. While the trees will grow back, the current situation has triggered floods, landslides, loss of fertile topsoil, increased temperatures, and other problems. The loss of trees and vegetation have been concerns in Haiti for decades, both from natural disasters fueled by climate change and from Haitians chopping down trees to make charcoal for fuel. Because the entire nation is almost treeless, from the air it's easy to see the boundary between Haiti and the Dominican Republic on the island of Hispaniola, which they share, where protected trees on the Dominican side stand in stark contrast to Haiti's barren landscape. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Haitian-American Yannick Joseph, the New Haven, Connecticut-based director of the Haiti Renaissance Institute. The Institute is a project of Green Cities, Green Villages, which is a sustainable development and renewable energy incubator founded by Joseph in 2001. Since 2010, she's worked with grassroots groups in Haiti, including the Association of Peasants of Fondwa and local development committees, to advocate the establishment of a Haitian National Forestry Corps.
A National Forestry Corps in Haiti is desperately needed, because, as you know, deforestation is massive in Haiti. Whenever there are floods, there are landslides, a lot of people die. And a National Forestry Corps would help with flood management and would also help to keep people from uprooting trees before they reach maturity. It takes about 10 years for a tree to reach maturity. That's a very long time in a country where people are impoverished. Also, a National Forestry Corps would also help to reforest marginal areas, areas that are hard to reach, like in mountains in Haiti. A National Forestry Corps would also create permanent jobs in forestry and flood management for Haitians. People may have heard that very recently the Haitian army was reconstituted. We at the Haitian Renaissance Institute think it was a very big mistake. Haiti does not need a Haitian army. What we need is a National Forestry Corps, and it can be financed by the Haitian government, by the World Bank, and other international institutions. We also believe that with the support of the American people and with institutions like Yale, a National Forestry Corps is a very doable achievement. The Dominican Republic has had a National Forestry Corps for more than 50 years, and it's about time that Haiti had one.
Besides your organization, is anybody else pushing for this? Are you working with other groups in Haiti?
Well, ironically, there has been talk for the creation of a National Forestry Corps on and off for the last 20 years. Even the former president, Michel Martelly, the entertainer, he spoke of a National Forestry Corps when he first came to power. But nothing has been done about forming a National Forestry Corps. And we, meaning the Haitian Renaissance Institute and the Peasants Association of Fondwa, we were very disappointed and very dismayed to find out that instead of the formation of a National Forestry Corps, a Haitian army, which we do not need, has been reconstituted. And I just want to say also that according to many climate change experts, right now, the most readily available alternative for developing countries to address carbon emissions is tropical reforestation, and there's funding for it.
So this would be something that you think is likely to come to pass in the next few years, would you say?
Yes, it is likely to come to pass, but we will need the support of the American people. We will need the support of New Haven and of Yale and other institutions of higher learning. We'll be working in Haiti to make it happen.
Are you aware of any projects, even like small projects locally in Haiti, to do any reforestation?
Yes, there are many reforestation projects in Haiti, but they are scattershot and they are not comprehensive. In order for us to have effective reforestation in Haiti, we need a number of factors. One of them is cooking fuel alternatives. This is why the University of Fondoua and the Haitian Renaissance Initiative, we have partnered also to introduce a number of renewable energy alternatives in Haiti. One of them is the anaerobic biodigester technology, which would provide cooking fuel through biogas to Haitian households, which would be a way to prevent people from cutting down trees to make charcoal. There are also other alternatives which consist of people and groups making charcoal out of the compressed waste paper and waste biomass, which is plant waste. They convert it into charcoal briquettes, and people are now buying these reconstituted charcoal briquettes as fuel alternatives.
That was Yannick Joseph of the Haiti Renaissance Institute. Learn more about the deforestation in Haiti and the proposal to establish a national forestry corps by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBSU in Brockport, New York, WTND in Macon, Illinois, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.